Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the August 1st, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week looks like a scene from The Christmas Carol, except instead of Ebenezer Scrooge, we have Donald Trump in the bed under his covers with his nightcap on, very frightened look on his face. And instead of the ghost of Christmas Past, we have the ghost of Jeffrey Epstein. He's holding up a picture of Trump and himself together, smiling and pointing a finger at Trump. The headline is Epstein's Ghost: Why Trump Can't Escape His Past Friendship with a Sex Offender. That is our first main story. We'll start right there. Trump tries to change subject from Epstein files. What happened? As bipartisan pressure built on the Trump administration to release files on convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, House Speaker Mike Johnson this week abruptly ended the legislative session and sent members home a few days early to avoid having to hold votes on the matter. It was a sharp turnaround for Johnson, who last week declared we should put everything out there and let the people decide. That was an apparent attempt to placate MAGA influencers and GOP lawmakers, angered by a Justice Department memo that stated the government had no evidence that the disgraced financier kept a long-rumored client list of rich and powerful pedophiles. When Democrats tried to force a procedural vote on a bipartisan measure calling for the administration to release all files on Epstein, who died by suicide in a Manhattan jail while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges in 2019, Johnson announced that the House was adjourning until September. "We're not going to play political games with this," he said. Meanwhile, scrutiny of President Trump's former friendship with Epstein grew after the Wall Street Journal reported that Trump sent a bawdy 2003 birthday card to Epstein with a drawing of a naked woman. Trump denied the report and filed a $10 billion defamation suit. The White House barred Journal reporters from the press pool for Trump's upcoming Scotland trip. Citing senior administration officials, the Journal later reported that Trump was told by Attorney General Pam Bondi in May that his name appeared multiple times in Epstein documents reviewed by the Justice Department. "Those mentions are not evidence of any wrongdoing." Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche said he would meet with Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell, who is serving a 20-year sentence for recruiting and grooming teenage girls abused by Epstein, to question her about the case. "No lead is off limits," he said. Hard-right GOP lawmakers who've led the charge for the document's release joined Democrats in hammering the administration. "For Trump's base, dangling bits of red meat no longer satisfies," said Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. "They want the whole steak dinner." Trump pivoted to take aim at former President Barack Obama, baselessly accusing him of treason because of a 2016 investigation by his administration into Russian election interference. Trump reposted a fake video showing Obama being arrested in the Oval Office and sitting in a jail cell. A spokesman for Obama called the accusations a weak attempt at distraction. What the columnist said: "There's no pretending otherwise," said Philip Elliott in Time. "Epstein has hijacked Washington. A desperate Johnson is betting that an early recess will provide an emergency off-ramp from a toxic topic that has sparked screaming matches in his caucus. Trump and his allies long fed conspiracy theories about Epstein and an elite cover-up. Now they're finding the shrapnel does not spare them when their promises to blow off the lid don't align with reality." The Epstein story will be quieted eventually, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. But it won't go away. Trump's most diehard contingent has shown that it can buck him. Podcaster Candace Owens accused Trump of thinking his base is stupid. Conspiracy peddler Alex Jones said, "You're not the Pope, bro." Meanwhile, Trump blasted his critics as weaklings and bad people. The ground has shifted, creating a fissure that could widen over time. As his MAGA base turns up the heat, Trump has resorted to an old tactic, distraction, said Nia Malika Henderson in Bloomberg. That's the obvious motivation behind the president posting the deepfake Obama video, and why the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, made criminal referrals to the DOJ over the absurd claim that Obama administration figures committed treasonous conspiracy in 2016. It's far from clear that Trump's attempts at distraction will work, said Matt K. Lewis in the Los Angeles Times. His supporters are normally so loyal they'd drink bleach at his behest, but this feels categorically different for a few reasons. A supposed cover-up of a pedophile cabal is what stirs MAGA passions, not corporate tax cuts, and the known details are too lurid and concrete to dismiss. Epstein really did traffic in underage girls and pal around with Trump. Attorney General Pam Bondi really did say in February that Epstein's client list was sitting on my desk. You don't need a tinfoil hat to notice the fishiness here. Trump and Epstein indeed enjoyed a long friendship, said Alan Foyer and Matthew Goldstein in the New York Times. The men spent nearly 15 years mingling side by side at lavish dinners at Epstein's Upper East Side mansion and raucous parties at Trump's Mar-a-Lago. One woman who said Epstein groomed and abused her was allegedly recruited while working at Mar-a-Lago. A swimsuit model said she was groped by Trump after being introduced to him by Epstein. Trump rode at least 7 times on Epstein's jet. And when Trump hosted a Calendar Girl competition party at Mar-a-Lago, Epstein was the only invited guest, according to someone who arranged the event. For Deputy AG Blanche to reach out to Maxwell is highly unusual, said Jordan Rubin in MSNBC.com, and raises questions. Convicted in 2021 of sex trafficking and other charges, Epstein's former right-hand woman is due for release in 2037. She wants out and is likely willing to help Trump politically. If she were to clear him in some way, might Trump trade a pardon for that? Count on it, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. And when it happens, you can count on Trump's followers to accept it as exoneration, no matter how much it stinks. It's the obvious ending for this affair. Character is destiny for the right as much as it is for Trump. And we'll read the second main story. ICE builds detention camps and ramps up arrests. What happened? The Trump administration accelerated efforts to build a network of massive ICE detention camps across the U.S. this week, even as lawmakers and human rights advocates detailed allegations of shocking conditions at overcrowded immigration jails in Florida. Detainees at 3 ICE facilities in the Miami area said they had to sleep on the floor in freezing, overcrowded cells. One detainee said they were chained with their hands behind them, so they had to bend down and eat with their mouths like dogs. Another said that when inmates demanded medical attention, officers disabled a surveillance camera and used stun grenades on them. When many existing detention facilities well over capacity, the Trump administration has awarded a $1.26 billion contract to build a tent camp at Texas Fort Bliss that would hold 5,000 beds. The Pentagon withdrew 700 Marines deployed to Los Angeles last month after anti-ICE protest. But following the shooting of an off-duty customs agent in Manhattan, allegedly by 2 undocumented men, Border Czar Tom Homan said he would send ICE agents to New York and other cities. Sanctuary cities are now our priority, he said. We're going to flood the zone. With crossings from Mexico at historic lows, the Border Patrol has begun deploying agents far from the southern border. Officers have detained day laborers at a Sacramento Home Depot and immigrants at court hearings in New York City. Better get used to us now, said Border Patrol official Gregory Bovino, because this is going to be normal very soon. What the editorial said. All this wretched excess does not poll well, said the Toledo Blade. Trump squandered America's initial support for deportations by embracing an un-American celebration of cruelty. Now the majority has turned against the whole project, especially Trump's masked marauding ICE agents. One poll found that a mere 31% approve of the massive injection of cash, $170 billion, that ICE got in a recently passed budget bill. Another that 78% support a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants who have committed no other crime. That would include many of the detainees in the Everglades tent prison the Trump administration gleefully calls Alligator Alcatraz, said the Miami Herald. At least 250 of the 700-plus detainees there have immigration violations but no criminal convictions or charges. Some of them are asylum seekers. Others arrived here under legal humanitarian parole programs, and at least one was just 15. These revelations should be chilling to Americans. Just how indiscriminate has the U.S. immigration system become? What the columnist said. Across the country, ICE agents are tearing families apart, terrorizing communities, and upending businesses, said Farah Hassan in Times of San Diego. Unofficial deportation czar Stephen Miller demands 3,000 arrests a day, so masked agents ignore due process and go for what appears to be racial profiling. They have been snatching Latino-looking people from churches, graduations, restaurants, Home Depots, farms, and other workplaces. One of the detained, Javier Diaz Santana, was a deaf and mute man legally here under DACA, said Brittany Mejia in the Los Angeles Times. He was grabbed near L.A. by ICE agents who didn't know or care who he was. I know you can tell I'm Mexican, Diaz recalled thinking, but he couldn't communicate with them. He languished for weeks in a Texas facility before being released. Trump is arresting a lot of people, said Fareed Zakaria in the Washington Post, but he's actually deporting far fewer than President Obama did. This term, Trump has removed some 14,700 immigrants per month, compared with Obama's peak of 36,000 in 2013. That's because rather than following the rules, laws, and norms that allow government to work effectively, he has prioritized optics. He's not more effective than his predecessors, just louder and meaner. As for those who do get deported, where are they going? Asked Jeff Crisp in the New York Times. The administration has sent thousands of people to poor and often unstable third countries, places they aren't from and aren't safe in. Trump has been telling leaders of these countries that they must take in U.S. deportees if they hope to clinch U.S. commercial deals. Explicitly, horrifyingly, he is rewriting the international asylum and refugee system and making a new one in which people are pawns. Controversy of the week. Rescissions. Trump's push to control federal spending. We've supported him for 56 years, said Rich Lowry in National Review, but it's time for Big Bird to make his own way in the world. At President Trump's urging, Senate Republicans passed a rare rescissions bill last week, clawing back some $9 billion in congressionally authorized spending, including about $8 billion in foreign aid and $1 billion for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which helps fund National Public Radio, PBS, and their local member stations. Liberals howled, and even moderate GOP Senator Susan Collin and Lisa Murkowski joined Democrats in opposition. But the outrage is misplaced. Institutions like NPR and Sesame Street have huge, loyal audiences that will ensure their survival. And in this age of media churn, it's ridiculous for the government to prop up a few select outlets, especially ones pervasively biased against conservatives. For NPR in particular, this is a self-inflicted wound, said former NPR editor Uri Berliner in the Free Press. In recent years, the network abandoned neutrality in favor of progressive, agenda-driven journalism, ignoring stories like Hunter Biden's laptop to run endless moralizing features on systemic racism and trans rights. This vote means NPR is now free to be as partisan as it chooses, while American taxpayers are free to choose which outlets they want to support with their own money. Complaints about the left-leaning assumptions of PBS and NPR have some merit, said the New York Times in an editorial. But defunding all of public media is the wrong solution. NPR will be just fine without the 2% of its budget that comes from the government, but the cuts will devastate hundreds of small radio and TV stations, often the only source of local news in rural areas, hastening the decline of America's once robust media ecosystem. That's the point, said Paul Fahrey in The Atlantic. It's all part of Trump's frontal assault on independent reporting, which has seen him file numerous lawsuits against insufficiently deferential news outlets, commandeer the White House press pool, and install loyalist Brendan Carr as head of the Federal Communications Commission. So far, he's winning this war. Trump also wants to diminish Congress, said Katie Edmonston in the New York Times. The $9 billion rescinded last week is a tiny share of the $7 trillion federal budget. But by getting lawmakers to reverse their own spending decisions, Trump weakened Congress's power of the purse and further asserted his maximalist view of presidential power. Russell Vaught, head of Trump's Office of Management and Budget, is already working on more rescission bills, said Ed Kilgore in New York. Because they can be passed by a simple filibuster-proof majority, they're an easy tool to impose absolute majority rule over all spending decisions, and especially useful when that majority is beholden to Trump. Vaught risks overplaying his hand, said Jennifer Schultes in Politico. Sure, with a grimace, Republicans gave the White House a win this time. But are they really going to become a rubber stamp for rescissions, letting Trump and Vaught make the ultimate end run around their funding power? Probably not, said Eric Bohm in Reason. And it's too bad. After the failure of DOGE and a Trump megabill that would add another $3.4 trillion to the deficit, last week's cuts brought a sliver of cheer to spending hawks. But the fact that it took the tie-breaking vote of Vice President J.D. Vance to enact these paltry savings is a depressing reminder of how hard it is to have Congress acknowledge, let alone tackle, our looming fiscal mess. It's time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Peronism. After the House Appropriations Committee approved a measure that would rename the Kennedy Center's Opera House the First Lady Melania Trump Opera House. Without giving specifics, Idaho Representative Mike Simpson said the move would honor the First Lady's support and commitment in promoting the arts and humanities. It was a good week for risk management. After the Steve Miller Band canceled every date of its 2025 North American tour, citing the combination of extreme heat, unpredictable flooding, tornadoes, hurricanes, and massive forest fires. In a statement, the band advised fans to always trust your instincts. It was a good week for American greatness. After Wisconsin's Caleb and Justine Roessler became the first U.S. couple to win the annual Wife-Carrying World Championship in Finland. There aren't many wives in the world who would agree to this, said a triumphant Caleb. She did a great job. But it was a bad week for punchlines. After a chicken crossing the road in Key West, Florida, was struck and killed by motorist Perla DeMiller. Cynthia Sosa, who had braked to avoid the chicken, allegedly then sprayed DeMiller with bear mace to teach her a lesson, and now faces assault charges. It was a bad week for Mondays after researchers in Hong Kong identified a neurobiological mechanism underpinning the dread many feel about the start of the work week. In particular, the study found a strong association between reported feelings of anxiety on Mondays and excessive levels of glucocorticoid production. It was a bad week for expats after Texas dad Derek Huffman, who moved his family to a Moscow suburb to escape woke America, signed up for a non-combat role in the Russian army, and was promptly sent to the front lines in Ukraine. He feels like he is being thrown to the wolves, said his wife, Deanna. And a short and other news piece on this page. EPA drafts plan to erase climate change regulations. The Environmental Protection Agency has drawn up a proposal to reverse a landmark scientific finding that lets the U.S. government regulate greenhouse gas emissions and combat climate change, the New York Times reported this week. The 2009 endangerment finding established that planet heating gases, including carbon dioxide and methane, pose a threat to human lives. It's the basis for regulations limiting such emissions from vehicles, factories, power plants, and other industries. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin intends to argue that imposing climate regulations on auto manufacturers harms human health because it leads to higher prices and reduced consumer choice, sources told the Times. If implemented, the proposal not only would erase current greenhouse gas regulations, but also would hamper future administrations' efforts to tackle climate change. Time for the briefing. Title this week, The Pentagon's Missing Missiles. The U.S. military is low on weapons. Can it restock before a major conflict breaks out? What is it running low on? Drones, missiles, ammunition, nearly everything. Weapons shipments have strained U.S. stockpiles, particularly deliveries to Ukraine, which burned through a year's worth of American 155-millimeter artillery in just 8 weeks in 2022, and to Israel. This month, the Pentagon paused transfers to Ukraine of Patriot missiles, precision-guided rockets, howitzer rounds, and more while it assessed inventory, though President Trump partly reversed that order. Middle East skirmishes have also eaten up material. In the $1.5 billion campaign to protect Red Sea shipping against Yemen Houthis rebels, the U.S. fired 125 Tomahawks and 155 Standard missiles and had seven Reaper drones shot down. And the Houthis are a ragtag militia compared with the real threat, China. When the Center for New American Security gamed out war with China, the U.S. fired 90% of its anti-ship cruise missiles and 80% of its land attack weapons in less than a week. We'd better hope the next conflict is short term, Representative Tom Cole, Republican from Oklahoma, said in May, because we don't have enough munitions to sustain a long-term fight. Can't the U.S. replace the weapons? Not fast enough. The defense budget is about $850 billion a year, but 22% goes to military salaries, and the biggest chunk, 39%, is for operations and maintenance. Only about 17% goes toward weapons procurement. And even if the Pentagon wanted to spend more, the U.S. industrial base has atrophied since the end of the Cold War. At this point, it may be incapable of meeting the munitions demand created by a potential future fight against a peer adversary, the Army Science Board said in a 2023 report. Defense analyst Mackenzie Eaglin, who co-authored that report, told The Atlantic that it's a miracle the U.S. military has anything that blows up ever. While companies are modernizing production, the process requires new equipment and skilled workers and will likely take years to complete. Shipbuilding, too, is lagging. The Navy had some 600 ships in 1987 and 300 now. Why is shipbuilding lagging? The U.S. industry dried up. Thanks to 19th century laws requiring that any voyage between two U.S. ports be made in a U.S. vessel, American shipbuilding was protected from international competition and lost its competitive edge. The U.S. did ramp up the building of naval and cargo ships during World War II, but sold them off after the war and dismantled the shipyards. Because of high cost, red tape, and a loss of subsidies, the U.S. now produces almost no ocean-going commercial ships, just five in 2022, compared with China's 1,794. And the few military ships the U.S. has built tend to be insanely expensive. The Navy spent $22.5 billion to build three Zunwalt-class destroyers, for example, only to cancel the program because the gun on them would be too costly. Restoring U.S. shipbuilding will be a generational project, said Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor under President Joe Biden, since we don't have the backbone of a healthy commercial shipbuilding base to rest our naval shipbuilding on top of. How did we get to this point? It's partly that weapons productions and shipbuilding declined, along with the general drop-off in U.S. manufacturing, but it's also the result of winning the Cold War. The Clinton administration swept into office in 1993, expecting to enjoy a peace dividend, and it slashed defense spending by some 15%, nearly two-thirds of which came from weapons procurement. That put many of the big defense contractors out of business, and by the end of the 1990s, the U.S. defense industrial base had shrunk from over 100 firms to just five. To this day, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, and Boeing dominate the market. Critics say this lack of competition has stifled innovation and poured defense dollars into costly and outdated weapon systems like fighter jets, guided missiles, and aircraft carriers. What should we be building instead? Drones. The U.S. arsenal is heavy on high-tech stuff like Tomahawk cruise missiles, $2 million each, interceptor missiles, up to $28 million, and F-35 fighter jets, $100 million. But as Russia's invasion of Ukraine has shown, quantity trumps quality in a protracted war. Kyiv has stayed in the fight thanks partly to its use of cheap drones that can swarm. Yet even if the Pentagon wanted to reorient around drones, its procurement process is clogged with red tape and designed for weapon systems that take 15 years to develop. Drone innovation is happening at warp speed, said Mark D. Jacobson, former professor at the Air Force's Air War College. But Defense Department acquisition is happening at industrial speed. Are changes underway? Yes, production of artillery ammo has accelerated and is expected to increase fivefold this year. The big spending bill passed earlier this month added $25 billion for munitions, $29 billion for shipbuilding, and $16 billion for drones. And the Army is planning a $36 billion overhaul to equip its 10 combat divisions with 1,000 drones each and improve anti-drone defenses. To pay for that, it will halt procurement of things drones can take out, like tactical vehicles and M10 light tanks. You've got to identify the attributes of a future force, said General Mark Milley, former chair of the Joint Chiefs. We are in the midst of a really fundamental change here. And moving into the best columns of the week, we'll read two from the U.S. Rubio's big gift to China. The U.S. State Department has a bizarre new mission, said Andreas Kluth, to make China great again. Secretary of State Marco Rubio recently fired about 1,350 state employees, calling them radical ideologues. Translation: these career diplomats and civil servants were not MAGA loyalists. Previously, Rubio killed the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, decimating its efforts to combat AIDS, malaria, and starvation abroad, and largely shut down the Voice of America and Radio Liberty. Who benefits from Rubio's reckless assault on the U.S.'s outreach to the world? Not America. Gutting U.S. aid will cause an estimated 14 million additional deaths over the next 5 years and destroy all the goodwill its humanitarian work created. China is stepping into the void and now outspends the U.S. in 40 countries in an effort to create long-term dependencies, a new report on Democrats on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee warns. Beijing's goal: to control these countries' critical minerals and crops and dominate foreign markets for China's renewable energy and electric vehicles. Perversely, the Trump administration is aiding and abetting China's pursuit of world domination. Never has a country blessed with such an abundance of soft power forfeited so much of it with so little justification. Vance's warped view of America. Who's a real American? Asked Jonah Goldberg. That's been a pet topic for Vice President J.D. Vance, who is denouncing the sinister forces who claim America is just an idea. America is no mere idea, Vance insisted in a recent speech. It is a group of people with a shared history and a common future. To accept that America is an idea, he said, would mean to accept as Americans maybe billions of foreign citizens who agree with America's founding principles, adding, must we admit all of them? Having set up that straw man, he went on to argue, it's absurd for the Anti-Defamation League to denounce right-wing extremists if they had ancestors who fought in the Civil War. MAGA fanatics who stormed the Capitol, he said, have a hell of a lot more claim over America than their progressive critics. Vance claims real Americanness for his tribe and no other, which is actually an un-American idea. He even confers special status on those whose Confederate ancestors fought to destroy the Union to defend slavery. Our nation's founders believed in equality before the law, not inherited status or privilege. That ideal is, in fact, central to what makes America great. This column comes from Cuba. Communist paradise? Not even close. Now we know what Cuba's communist rulers really think about the poor, said Yoani Sanchez. Labor Minister Marta Elena Fieto Cabrera, talking to lawmakers last week, unleashed a bitter tirade against people who beg for money in public or rummage through garbage to find rotting fruit or moldy bread to eat. There are no beggars in Cuba, she said, only fakers out to make easy money. No lawmaker dared point out to her that we're in an economic crisis featuring high inflation, blackouts, and food shortages. Many people are homeless. Fortunately, we have social media. Feito's comments went viral, and that has put unprecedented pressure on the regime. Authorities usually deflect blame by asserting that Cuba's system is better than capitalism, but there was no defending Feito's contemptuous tone. President Miguel Díaz-Canel was forced to acknowledge that many Cubans are enduring hardships, saying the revolution cannot leave anyone behind. And Feito actually resigned, the first time in half a century that public pressure has ousted a government minister. Still, removing one minister is just a cosmetic move. It does nothing to help the needy, who know all too well that the loss of our civic and individual freedoms has not been worth it. And the last word, our feature article, Love in the Age of Ice. Chris Allred was convinced that all undocumented migrants were takers and parasites, said Sabrina Tavernise in the New York Times. Then he met Gelly. Bentonville, Arkansas. In the northwest corner of Arkansas, immigrants, mostly from Mexico, began arriving in the 1980s to work in the region's thriving poultry industry. For many here, this was ultimately a welcomed development. Immigrants, they say, are a big part of the region's extraordinary economic success. Chris Allred, who has lived in this area all his life, doesn't see it that way. Allred, a recruiter at a trucking company, does not like people who enter the country without permission, without legal permission. He believes they are an army of takers, filling spots in emergency rooms and schools that American citizens have to pay for. He does not like President Donald Trump either, but one of the reasons he voted for him last year was that it seemed as if he would actually take action on immigration. We don't have an industrial base anymore, Allred told me over dinner at his apartment in Bentonville. We have trillions in national debt. It's impossible. We can't take on millions more people. It's financially not possible. But something has happened in Allred's life that is bumping up against this view. He finally met and married the love of his life, and his wife is in the country illegally. Allred's story may be unusual, but his views of immigration are not. For many Americans, a loose border is like a house with no door or a club with no membership restrictions. It makes belonging or being inside mean less. But once the door is closed and the question becomes what to do with those inside, things get complicated quickly. It all sounds great until you get a call from the mayor of a small community who says, "Why are your agents catching the dad of the valedictorian of our high school class?" said Asa Hutchinson, the former governor, Republican governor of Arkansas who lives in the neighboring town of Rogers and helped oversee border enforcement in President George W. Bush's administration. "Everybody wants to enforce the law until it hits home with a personal story," he said. Allred, 48, grew up on a farm in western Arkansas. He watched his father, a machinist, struggle to navigate a rapidly changing economy. His father lost 3 factory jobs when the companies that employed him either closed or moved their production abroad, including to Mexico. He tried raising chickens but ended up losing his investment. Allred went to college, something his father hadn't done, but during his first year, his mother died of breast cancer, and he dropped out. His sister had been murdered the year before, and the tragedies knocked his life off course. For years, he was depressed. He contemplated suicide. He went from job to job, working in pool maintenance and sales, ad sales at a newspaper, HIV counseling, and as a security guard at a nightclub. He wanted a family, but he never felt stable enough to provide for one. 2 things broke the cycle. In 2018, he got a job he liked, working for a trucking company that was part of the now booming economy of Northwest Arkansas. And he moved back to the farm to take care of his beloved grandmother, Lita Mae Allred, who was 92. She told him that she prayed every day that he would find someone to marry, and when she died on his 44th birthday, he promised himself he would try. In the summer of 2023, using a dating app, he matched with a woman in southern Illinois. Her name was Galini, and she was from Ecuador. She was cute, he thought, and talkative. This was the only person I've ever been on text with for 12 hours nonstop. I've never been like that, he told me over dinner. Galini, who goes by Geli, had prepared an Ecuadorian dish of spicy fish soup. She had told Allred how she had moved from her small town to the capital, Quito, where she worked her way up in a media company, but lost the job when the company closed. She started a restaurant in the town she was from, but lost it in a flood. She decided that the way to get ahead financially was to go to the United States. So she left her 3 children, now ages 5, 8, and 23, with her father, and paid a coyote to make the trip. The more they talked, the more he felt attached. At some point, he also began to realize that she seemed to be in trouble. She was working in a restaurant and having arguments with the man who ran it. This activated something inside him. She needed his help. He told her he would drive up to see her. "I just knew I had to help her," he said. It was late when he walked into the bar where she told him to meet her. He was nervous. As soon as they saw each other, he said, they kissed. Allred calls it their Hollywood moment. "I knew I loved her from that exact time. I just knew," he said. "I call it the spark." He told her he'd pay for a ticket back to Ecuador, or she could come to Arkansas with him. She chose Arkansas. He proposed later that summer. They got married on Lita Mae's birthday, December 30th, in Liberty Baptist Church in Dutch Mills, Arkansas, the church she had belonged to for 75 years. "She's the woman that my grandma prayed for me to find," Allred said. Allred's objection to illegal immigration started with what he saw growing up. Arkansas jobs, like his father's, going to Mexico, and Mexican workers coming to Arkansas. Those immigrants, he believes, were good for people who owned chicken companies, but less so for everybody else. More recently, immigrants were coming illegally from all over the world, not just Mexico. Allred remembers thinking that it felt like anybody could get in. "This is going to be an absolutely horrendous thing I want to say, but if you can't talk about the truth, you really can't have a real conversation," he said. "They're parasites. What do parasites do? Over time, they eventually kill the host. And that's what this country's headed towards." One of the immigrants who had come in this most recent wave was Galini Allred. Her life seemed to contradict a lot of Chris Allred's assumptions. She was entrepreneurial. She started a cleaning business a few months after arriving in Arkansas. She was learning English quickly. She was not taking government benefits. She was not even going to the doctor. And she followed driving rules closer than he ever did. So how did Chris reconcile these two versions of what an illegal immigrant was? Had his views changed? Before I had the chance to ask him, Gelly did. "Baby, baby, I have a question," she said to him after she'd put away the soup. "Before me, you didn't like illegal immigrants?" "I still don't," he said. She laughed and turned to me to explain. "He doesn't like bad immigrants. He doesn't like lazy immigrants who take all that's free in this country," she said. "Maybe he likes good immigrants, smart, hard-working immigrants." Chris dipped into dessert, a slice of tiramisu. He acknowledged that there was an inconsistency between his views and his experience with his wife. "I'm a walking contradiction," he said, smiling. He said if he'd known that Gelly had immigrated illegally from the beginning, he doubts he would have pursued a relationship with her. "I may have said, hey, you know what? Guess what? Have a nice life. Good luck," he said. But he was in love, so he called a lawyer. Allred hired Aaron Cash, an immigration lawyer in the town of Rogers. His law partner is a man who fled the Civil War in El Salvador in the 1980s. Their office in a building that used to be a TV station is next to a Walmart. Many of his clients are walk-ins. Cash got into immigration law by accident. Some of his friends were police officers, and he wanted to become a prosecutor. But he did not get hired as one after law school, so he ended up taking a job in an immigration law firm. At the time, he said, I was clueless. Like many people he knew, he assumed that becoming legal in America was easy. How hard can it be, he said, describing the thinking, which he said had long been common even among his lawyer friends who don't know this area of law. He eventually learned how hard it really was. Paths to legal residence for immigrants are extremely limited. Even those with a privileged connection, such as a spouse or an adult child who is a citizen, often have to leave the country first and wait years. Every single person wants to do it the legal way, if there is one, Cash said. But for the vast majority of people he meets with, there isn't one. On June 2nd, the Allreds were faced with a decision. They learned in an immigration court in Chicago that either they could file an asylum claim for Gelly, or she would have to leave the country. There was no other path available if she wanted to continue the legal process. For Chris, it was the end of a two-year journey into an unfamiliar world. He has been to court hearings, paid legal fees, and seen firsthand how hard it is to get legal status. I asked if it had changed him. He said it had made him a little softer, a little more aware, a little more compassionate. He said he learned that the law was so slow and so restrictive that it was difficult to follow. He gave an example of a Haitian woman with her teenage son waiting ahead of them in line in Chicago. She was given a court date 2 years out. He said the legal limbo that creates is dangerous for immigrants. You work black market jobs, he said. You can't have a bank account. You've got to carry cash. You're extremely vulnerable. I interviewed dozens of people in Northwest Arkansas, and many expressed discomfort with the way Trump was going about reducing the numbers of immigrants lacking permanent legal status in this country. They liked the goal in the abstract, but the particulars of courthouse arrest and workplace raids rubbed many the wrong way. This was also true for Allred. He called the arrest at courthouses a dirty trick played on people who were trying to follow the law. You show up, you think you're trying to do the right thing, and ICE is right outside the door. No warning, nothing, he said. I think if a person takes the responsibility to show up, they deserve a chance to at least go through the process. After their court hearing in Chicago, Gelly decided to leave the United States. Chris thought she had a reasonable asylum case, but if she lost, it would be much harder to return, and she was not willing to risk that. So she is going back to Ecuador. She has until September 2nd to exit. Chris is going with her. Shortly after turning 48, he will become an immigrant. He will be the one asking for entry and trying to make his way. He said he has no idea what to expect. The only time he has been out of the United States was an hour in Tijuana, Mexico. He admits that he is terrified. He has been staying up late, doom-scrolling murder rates in Ecuadorian cities. You know, to myself, I've said a few times, I just kind of want my simple little life back, he said. Instead, he's preparing to leave the country. He's studying Spanish and selling his belongings. He is starting to think about how he might work in Ecuador, maybe in medical tourism. He said he hoped Geli would eventually become legal and that they will get to return to the United States, maybe even with her children. I've said to my friends, maybe helping her get her kids and bring them to a place where they can have some opportunity, said. Maybe that's the one thing I do good in my life. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. And we've got time for one of the Talking Points articles. We'll go with Democrats. The 2028 race has begun. The 2028 Democratic primaries have already kicked off in South Carolina, said Brackton Booker and Elena Schneider in Politico. A host of presidential hopefuls have descended on the early primary state, testing stump speeches, previewing lines of attack against President Trump and the GOP, and aiming to introduce themselves to a set of influential voters. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear and California Governor Gavin Newsom have toured some of the state's rural counties. In May, Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota and Governor Wes Moore of Maryland headlined state party events where they rubbed elbows with South Carolina kingmaker Representative Jim Clyburn. As the party scrambles to find a path forward, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times, its moderate, highly popular governors should be the face of the Democratic Party. Kansas Governor Laura Kelly is a pragmatic centrist who has rescued the state from fiscal disaster. Governors Beshear, Moore, Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, and Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania are also proven problem solvers and vote getters. Outside the Beltway, there's a good farm team in state capitals. Democrats already have an obvious central message in 2026 and 2028, said Lauren Egan in the Bulwark. In the midterms, they should portray Donald Trump, his policies, and the entire GOP as a protection racket for the elites. Trump's frantic efforts to shield himself from the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, combined with the brutal Medicaid cuts in his budget, will enable Democrats to say Trump kept the Epstein files secret, protecting his rich business friends, while also giving them tax breaks paid for by your health care. Democrats now have a cohesive narrative that Trump and the GOP are not a scourge of, but a protector of the rich and powerful. To win elections, Democrats first need to resolve their identity crisis, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. The party's brand is badly damaged, and Democrats now stand at a fork in the road. One road leads to the progressive populism championed by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and New York mayoral candidate Zohran Mamdani, which scapegoats billionaires and big tech for the country's complicated social problems. But raising taxes on billionaires alone won't fix what America ails, what ails America. The other road leads to the pragmatist, technocrat-driven approach that enabled Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama to win two elections each. For Democrats, replicating Trump's populism is not the answer. And a few of the short notes. Americans who get health insurance through the Affordable Care Act will see their monthly premiums jump an average of 75% next year, According to an analysis by the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation, the rise is largely due to the end of COVID-era enhanced subsidies, which started under the Biden administration and helped ACA enrollment more than double to a record 24 million people. The Trump administration has been accused of resisting court orders in a third of more than 160 major judicial rulings against it. Plaintiffs say administration lawyers have defied rulings, provided false information, and failed to turn over evidence. Judges have often agreed, but none have taken punitive actions to force compliance. The National Weather Service issued a record 3,040 flash flood warnings from January 1st through July 15th, more than any other year for that time period since 1986, when the modern alert system was adopted. In early July, the U.S. experienced at least four 1-in-1,000-year downpours in less than a week. On the poll watch, 47% of Americans believe artificial intelligence will have a negative impact on society, a 13-point jump from November 2024. 27% think AI will have a positive impact. And we'll finish today's show with a quote from George Washington, who said, "The bosom of America is open to receive not only the opulent and respectable stranger, but the oppressed and persecuted of all nations and religions." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.